I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the UAE amidst another US Gulf war. This week marks the anniversary of Washington's atomic annihilation of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945, killing over 200,000 civilians, mostly women and children, after Japan had already been defeated. The slaughter was preceded by a relentless campaign of dehumanization. Defending the bombings in a letter to a clergyman, then US President Harry Truman wrote, "When you have to deal with a beast, you have to treat him like a beast." More than 80 years later, where is America's moral reckoning as the only nation ever to use nuclear weapons against civilians? What followed were 8 decades of militarization with millions dead in wars of regime change, resource theft and proxy conflicts from Korea to Vietnam, Iraq to Libya and beyond. Today, Washington remains the principal backer of Israel's genocides in Gaza and Lebanon, continues to fuel conflict with Iran and props up the corrupt Zelensky regime in Kiev, all the while lecturing the world about morality. Joining me again is Dr. Gabor Maté, best-selling author of The Myth of Normal, Trauma, Illness and Healing in a Toxic Culture, a retired physician and infant survivor of the Holocaust. He is one of the most prominent voices of how trauma shapes individuals and societies. He joins me now from British Columbia in Canada. Thank you so much, Dr. Maté, for coming back on Going Underground. It's been a while, actually, not since before the most recent genocidal antics in Palestine. But, you know, before we get to the genocide survivors of Gaza, Lebanon, West Bank, survivors in Iran, for you personally, how has it been watching these massive NATO nation-backed wars affecting you, affecting all of us? I mean, how has it been for you personally to watch it happen?
You know, I grew up, I was born during the Second World War. I grew up in the Cold War era. I've seen wars, I've seen atrocities committed around the world by all kinds of parties. This last few years have been particularly tough because never before have we seen it so nakedly reported and portrayed and available. And to watch the world go by along its merry way, largely ignoring these horrors, it's a new experience, only because of the way that's in our face right now. We can't get away from it, and yet we also feel so helpless in the face of it. It's been emotionally very challenging, and it breaks my heart.
I mean, what is the impact of exposure to the images of on social media? I mean, in a sense, of course, it's good that people get to know that things are happening in a way that we wouldn't have before, say, in the Korean War when 20% of the population was wiped out. I mean, say the genocide in Gaza, but say the schoolgirls in Menab in Iran. What is the impact on people in the NATO countries that are funding these wars psychologically?
Well, there's several impacts. One is denial and just to try and escape from it so that we pay attention to trivialities that make no difference to our lives, such as which Hollywood star is marrying, which football player, you know, and this gets a lot of attention, but it's all, people don't realize it, but it's their attempt to escape reality. So that's one response. Another response is people to feel really brokenhearted and helpless. And there's something called moral injury, which is where you're watching something that goes against your heart, your values, and you're helpless to intervene. And a lot of people are brokenhearted and really upset. And then the third response is it propels people into action. They say, I have to do something. And that's the most positive response, is that even if they can't immediately affect the events, they don't stay on the sidelines. They get engaged, they get activated, and that's the healthiest response. So we're seeing all three: denial, kind of a helpless moral injury, but also a lot of people are getting active and involved.
I mean, we can see evidence of a third one when we see journalists in Gaza or journalists on the ground in Lebanon, medics. How does one turn the trauma from those first two ones into the third one to make trauma useful, make it become useful?
Well, you know, it's the same thing with personal traumas. Some people who experience trauma are crushed by it. Others go into various forms of escapist behavior. But some people learn from their traumas and they use what they learn to try and make a better world for other people and for everybody. And so it's the same with this social trauma and political trauma. It's The third one requires really coming to terms with how painful it is, but not allow that pain to crush you, but letting, using it as a way of, as fuel, really, for your sense of justice and sense of commitment. And, you know, we see that. I mean, I'm not to speak of Jews as anybody special, but a lot of young Jews now are, instead of going along or staying silent in the face of the mainstream narrative, are now coming to reject what they've been taught is their sense of entitled victimhood, and they're actually actively supporting Palestinian rights. That's a new phenomenon on a much larger scale than we've ever seen before. And that's just one example. It's happening all over the world, actually.
Well, you've campaigned for equal rights all around the world for so long. Actually, on that point, I mean, a majority of US Jews are unfavorable now to Israel, according to recent polls. How is it that American Jews, specifically in the United States, have come around to understanding the need for equal rights in West Asia?
Well, it's rather impressive because they're doing it in the face of propaganda that all their lives has enveloped them, and not just the upbringing within the Jewish communities, which have been completely Zionist inflected, but also the mainstream media. And so that for people to be able to see past that is quite remarkable. But it's, we saw the same thing in the Vietnam War, where in the face of all the propaganda, the large majority of American youths came to oppose that war. So people do have a sense of truth inside them. And let's face it, in the Jewish tradition, there's a powerful strain of going against authority and rejecting secular power and seeking for truth within. And that's the prophetic tradition, which is honored in Jewish tradition. It's honored sometimes more in the breach than in the observance, but it's certainly there. So it's completely consistent with Jewish tradition to stand up against authority and the chauvinistic tribal identification that every country wants its people to engage in. And there's a powerful countercurrent, which is no, yeah, there's a truth, there's a higher truth, which is greater than what your government is telling you. And you owe that to yourself to honor that truth. And that's very powerful in Jewish tradition. So it's very encouraging, but it's not entirely surprising.
Yeah, of course, it's not the case in Israel itself. And part of the antipathy with Israel by U.S. Jews, like broader pro-Palestine movements, is to individualize it all around this one figure of Netanyahu. Why do you think that is the key demonization here, that it's somehow all Netanyahu's fault? How does that psychologically work?
Well, Netanyahu is a fairly despicable figure, no matter how you look at him. He's one of the most dishonest, brutal, hypocritical politicians ever to tread the surface of the earth. And that's saying a lot. But he is not by himself the cause or the source of what's going on. What's actually going on is the logical and inevitable and foredoomed expression of the Zionist movement, which from the very beginning has dehumanized the Palestinians and has always arrogated to itself the right to displace and oppress and dismiss and kill as many as possible or as necessary of a Palestinian population. So Netanyahu is nothing new. He's simply the most egregious expression of the Zionist dynamic. But that has been there all along. And whether you look at previous terrorist prime ministers like Shamir or Begin, or whether you look at war criminals like Ben-Gurion, who literally fomented the displacement and killing of large numbers of Palestinians. It's a logic that is becoming more and more toxic, but very consistent to itself. So the figure of Netanyahu is not that important. It's the system that matters. And if you look at the current Israeli election, none of the opposition parties even dare speak about a Palestinian state anymore. That's just off the plate. So that, you know, we talk about the slogan from the river to the sea, but that is the Zionist ethic, that from the river to the sea, there's no non-Jewish entity. Netanyahu didn't create that. He simply embodies it.
Why is it so easy to dehumanize people? And clearly it's necessary. For instance, Russians now dehumanized for the war on Russia through Ukraine. Hey, how is power so able to dehumanize entire peoples?
Well, that's always been the case. So there's nothing new about that. For the colonial system, for example, to be able to take over large parts of the world, Africa, Asia, the Americas, Australia, the indigenous people had to be dehumanized. Because if we see them as equal to ourselves and worthy of the same respect that we expect for ourselves, we couldn't do to them what we did. And so dehumanization happens in the First World War. Both sides dehumanized each other. The you know, the Allies dehumanized the Germans, the Boche, the Germans, of course, dehumanized the Slavs. This has been going, this is a human dynamic, is that whenever you have an attachment to power and to acquisition and to privilege, you have to dehumanize the other. That's just a common human.
How does one stop it? Dynamic. I suppose is what I should have asked. How does one stop that and prevent that?
You know, if I'm honest with myself, I recognize that possibility in myself and sometimes in my personal relationships. I don't see the full humanity of the other person. And I think we all do that. So this is, I think it begins by looking at yourself, to tell you the truth.
I won't ask further about that. But, I mean, speaking about the conflict in Europe, I mean, at least there are kind of fake negotiations that go on from time to time as regards Palestine. European leaders, they believe that no negotiation should ever occur with Russia at all. How do you explain that mentally for all the leaders of all the Western European countries say, no, we shouldn't even make phone calls to Moscow, say, and yet millions may have been killed?
You know, I'll leave the Ukraine-Russia war to my son Aaron, who's going to be publishing a book about that in a few months. It's called Our Bullets, Their Blood. And but in any conflict, as long as a side thinks that it's winning or it's possible to win, it's not going to want to negotiate, because negotiations mean concessions. Negotiations means some kind of compromise. It means recognizing the possible legitimacy of what the other person is saying. And as long as you're committed to total victory and you think you can achieve it, you're going to dismiss negotiations as some kind of a unacceptable compromise. So this is true all the time. The Europeans seem at this point still to be convinced that they can win this war and that they can force Russia to its knees. And as long as they think that, they're not going to want to negotiate. Whether that turns out to be a tragic mistake, as it likely will, that's another question.
Dr. Gabon-Wate, we will have your son on about his book in a later Going Underground. I'll stop you there, though, and we'll have more from the best-selling author of The Myth of Normal, Trauma, Illness, and Healing in a Toxic Culture after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with retired physician and best-selling author of The Myth of Normal, Trauma, Illness, and Healing in a Toxic Culture, Dr. Gabor Mate. Dr. Mate, we were talking about Ukraine. I suppose the other major war, especially from where I'm speaking to you, is, of course, the Trump-Netanyahu war on Iran. You, I understand, have spoken to Iranians, some of them children of those who experienced the Anglo-American-backed Saddam Hussein war on Iran. What have you made of their reactions to the mass aerial bombardment of the Islamic Republic of Iran?
Yeah, I know many Iranians in Canada who are not supporters of the Islamic regime, who are rather secular, sophisticated people, but who nevertheless totally abhor the Western assault on their country. They don't want to see their country bombed, their relatives threatened, their families under siege. Now again, you know, like with any people, there's divisions. Some Iranians, as you and I both know, wanted foreign intervention, wanted Israeli intervention and American intervention in their hope that this will cause the fall of the Islamic government. But there are many opponents of the Islamic government, let alone its supporters, but there are many opponents of the Islamic government who have got nothing to do with and who are completely appalled by the carnage caused by the West in their country. So they're very, conflicted, because they don't want this government to continue to torture its people and to lash people because they don't wear the hijab, or torture people in jails, all the stuff that we know that government has done. But at the same time, they can't stand the idea of the same West that supported Saddam Hussein's assault on Iran with hundreds of thousands of deaths and use of poison gas and all this. They don't want this West to be intervening in their country.
And do they understand that their opposition on human rights grounds has catalyzed the ability of NATO countries to then tell their populations this is a just war in some way? And why does this spread so far into NATO post-1945 policy? I mean, you think of Cubans in Miami who want perhaps bombing of Cuba, Venezuelans who want bombing of Venezuela, their country, Russians who hate Russia and want the killing of Russians to change their governments. What's going on psychologically?
Well, usually when you look at those populations, they were the ones that were privileged.
And Palestinians, I should say, as well, who support Israel. Yeah.
Well, you know, usually the Cubans who support the anti-Cuban measures of the American government, the brutal blockade and economic sanctions that are destroying that country, the military incursions and so on, they come from the strata that were privileged under the pre-Castro revolution. And in every country, there's class divisions, and every country there are those that identify with previously existent. They had no problem with human rights as long as that was trampled upon by the Shah. But they have trouble with human rights when it's trampled upon by the Islamic regime. So it has to do with their class identification and their standing in the old society. Where they lost privilege, they'll hate the system that took away their privilege, and they'll support any assault on it. Doesn't matter what the impact on the rest of the population is. So we see this all the time in exiled populations.
And I know you've talked about this before, about the politicization of empathy. Maybe you could tell me a little bit about that. And actually, is it cross-generational? Is it epigenetic? Explain what the politicization of empathy, how it's involved in these NATO nation wars.
Well, I'm not sure what to make of that question, but if I let it percolate in my mind, there's such a thing as selective empathy, so that people are encouraged to empathize with some people, but not with everybody. So that people are encouraged to empathize with the victims, and there are many, of the Islamic government in Iran, but not with the victims of the American and Israeli assault on Iran. People are encouraged to empathize with the Ukrainian victims, and there have been many of that. Whatever you think of the war, there have been many people that have died and suffered as a result of the war. And so that there's an article yesterday, a couple of days ago, in the New York Times about children's books in Ukraine that help Ukrainian children come to terms with death in war of their family members. Well, it's a lovely impulse, but you never see that about Palestinians. So that it's a selective empathy. So the Palestinians, who by any measure, not that you want to compare suffering, but by any measure, have endured much more death proportionately and much more displacement and suffering and lack of support and starvation than the Ukrainians. You'll never see such an empathetic article about Palestinian children in the New York Times. So what you call the politicization of empathy is really a selective empathy, is that we empathize with the people that we perceive on being on our own side, and we completely deny empathy to those that we see not as of being on our side. So it's a selection of empathy directed in political directions. That's what I'd call the politicization of empathy.
And elite power has become more sophisticated at deploying that?
Well, they're wonderful at it. I mean, the Western propaganda system, I grew up under communism in Hungary, and there was a propaganda system there. It was very crude, and everybody could see through it. People, we couldn't talk about it because that would incur some consequences, but everybody could see it. In the West, the propaganda system is so subtle and so pervasive and so persuasive that people don't even know they're being propagandized. So they'll see that article about the Ukrainian children just for what it is, but they won't see it as part of selective empathy. And they'll never think, well, what about Palestinian children?
I mean, I know when you came on last time, you felt uncomfortable about using the term genocide when it came to Gaza. I think you've changed your mind. I mean, we had Omar Bartov, the famous Brown University scholar, who called it out as a genocide. Do you think the leaders of the countries in Western Europe that were arming Israel, without which Israel could not have committed the genocide, what do you think about their leaders' psyches, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris and all those figures? Because they must have seen the evidence.
Well, as a matter of fact, more recently published books have made it clear that they did see the evidence. And people like Jake Sullivan and others who at that time justified it. Yeah, Tony Blinken. They had qualms about it all along, but of course they never said so publicly. So it's not that they didn't know, it's that their conscience took second place to their political allegiances. And as far as the word genocide, yeah, I was uncomfortable with it because I had a different conception of it. But you know what? It turns out I don't get to decide what a genocide is. Genocide is a legal term, which has got a legal definition. And according to the vast majority of world genocide experts, including the vast majority of Jewish genocide experts, what Israel has committed in Gaza meets the legal criteria for the definition of genocide. So whatever I thought about it subjectively is irrelevant. And there's two Hebrew University Jewish scholars who wrote an article in the Israeli newspaper Haaretz who said, there's no Auschwitz in Gaza, but there's genocide. And that's the consensus. And any political leader that ignores that simply does it, like Blinken and Sullivan did, for opportunistic purposes. I'm sure when they write their memoirs, they'll admit that they knew something more than they were willing to acknowledge publicly these days.
The censorship clearly failed then when it came to the genocide in Gaza. But today, you're not going to see what's happening in Lebanon today on your television screens in North America. You're not going to see the other view of the Ukraine conflict from the Russian perspective. Because it's censored.
It's really remarkable. Whatever you think of, for example, the Ukraine war, you should at least be able to articulate what the other side says about it. You might not agree with it. But when you don't even know, you're not even presented with what is the other side's perspective, what is the history there that the Russians are responding to, not to justify the invasion, but what is their perspective, what is their historical experience. If you can't even articulate that, then how can you possibly make up your mind about who's right and who's wrong, or the mixed up rights and wrongs involved in a particular conflict? And when I speak with Zionists, which I don't much anymore, but it's not that they know, is that they don't even know what they're talking about. They have no idea what the experience of the other side is, and his failure to recognize the experience of the other side is just a commonest human failure, commonest. This happens in personal relationships where we all have our perspective and our grievance and we don't even recognize the perspective of the other side. And it's writ large in the political realm where we don't have a clue and we don't even want to. What is the other side actually saying? What is their experience? What are their concerns? And this applies in a big time to every conflict in the world, including the Ukraine-Russian conflict.
And just finally, I mean, the United States attacked with Tomahawk missiles that school in southern Iran, killing more than 160 school children. For the survivors of an attack like that, is the easiest way out of trauma then to politicize their rage? Is that the easiest way to get over the trauma in the short term?
I don't think I'm in a position to advise people that have lost their children in a bombing.
How should they cope? And how should the this program will be seen, of course, in Palestine, as it is seen in across West Asia? Just very briefly, what's the main pointer to be able to cope with massive bereavement on the scale that the United States has been meeting out?
Well, the first response needs to be just grief. And grief is a human impulse. It's wired into our brains to come to terms with loss. So the first thing is to grieve and to have that grief understood and validated by your community and by people around you. Then you can think about what you're going to do next. But until we fully grieve and feel the pain of it, we don't really have a basis to move forward. Anger, yes, there needs to be anger. And even if that anger is impotent in the sense that you can't direct it against anybody and you can't do much with it, just to be able to feel it means that you're a human being and you haven't given up.
Dr. Gabriel Mate, thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's it for the show. Our condolences to all those of you bereaved or affected by Washington's wars of aggression. We'll be back on Saturday with a brand new show. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media. If it's not censored in your country, and head to our channel, Going Underground TV, on rumble.com to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Saturday.